The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're going to look at some viral invaders that use our bodily fluids to spread themselves. We'll speak to researcher Abby Smith about HIV, the latest science, the search for a vaccine, and the dangerous misinformation spread by conspiracy theorists. But first, we'll talk about another virus, HPV, and its headline-grabbing vaccine. I'm here with Dr. Peter Leone. Peter is a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and an adjunct associate professor of epidemiology at the Gilling School of Global Public Health. He's also the medical director of the North Carolina HIV STD Prevention and Control Branch. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Peter.
Well, thanks. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
So tell us about HPV.
HPV is human papillomavirus. It is a DNA-containing virus that is protein-encapsulated, meaning the outside part of the virus is made up of proteins. Many viruses are made up of lipids or fatty acids. As a result of HPV being made up of protein on the outside, it's pretty hardy. So it can actually live in the environment for periods of time. And that may actually contribute somewhat to transmission. There are over 150 different types of HPV, of which about 32 or so affect the genital tract, of which 15 are associated with cancer of the genital tract. And it causes an infection of what we call squamous epithelial cells. So these are skin cells and mucosal cells. And but what I mean by mucosal cells, the cells that line the mouth, the anus, the vagina, the cervix, all can be infected by HPV. And so we can see different types of infection and disease manifestation depending on the location of infection and the subtype of HPV.
So now there's a difference between herpes and genital warts.
Yes, big difference. The commonality here is that you can get them both by having sex. And sex in a very broad sense, in that we're talking about skin-to-skin contact. So I think of sexually transmitted infections in two categories: things that are transmitted through bodily fluids and those that are transmitted by skin-to-skin contact. HPV and herpes simplex 1 and 2 are transmitted through skin-to-skin contact for the most part. The issues around herpes have to do with recurrent disease, and it is the most prevalent infection in North America in terms of sexually transmitted infections. We estimate about 17% of adults have genital herpes due to HSV2. HPV, human papillomavirus, only infects humans and is a cause of warts as well as cervical cancer when we look at disease manifestation. And if we look at how common it is the most common infection. So prevalence, we talk in terms of at any one given time, how many people are currently infected. For HPV, we estimate about 10% of adult women will have a genital HPV infection any given time. However, the course of a lifetime, about 70-75% of adults will have had HPV infection during the course of their life. So it really is more of a marker of sexual activity, and I hate to say it, but it's sort of inevitable. If you're sexually active, you're likely to contract HPV infection. And most of the time, nothing happens. Those infections are cleared.
So why doesn't the body just naturally fight it off?
Viruses have the same goal in life that human beings do, and that is to pass on their DNA or RNA. In this case, it's DNA. So it sort of evolved along the same lines in humans to avoid detection. What's interesting about HPV, it's a pretty simple virus with a small number of proteins, but it infects what we call the basal epithelial cells of the skin. So as skin matures, it actually matures from the base up, and those basal epithelial cells pretty much lay there without doing much until they begin to mature. They then will move up to the surface. In the case of squamous keratinized cells, they will harden and flake off, but these are also the same cells that will cover the cervix, the urethra in men, and the anal area in both men and women. HPV has to be introduced usually through trauma to infect the basal layer. And it will infect the cell and then pretty much lay dormant for several months before it begins to actually replicate. Replication seems to be tied towards maturation of those cells. And when that happens, then you begin to get replication of the virus itself and potentially hijacking of that cell in terms of its genetic material. Because of that 2 to 3 month lag period, any inflammation that might have been associated with trauma is no longer present. And so if a person does not have previous exposure to that specific subtype of HPV, they don't have an antibody response that will help clear the virus, and not very many proteins are presented on the outside of cells. And so it eventually avoids the body and will stay there for a long period of time until either an immune response is obtained and the virus is cleared, or in the case of the development of cancer, those cells become immortalized, and now you have transformation of cells into cancer, and so the body doesn't respond very well against self, and these cancers can go on and produce significant disease, morbidity, and mortality.
And there's now a vaccine, two types of vaccines, actually. Can you tell us about them?
Well, there are two approved vaccines, Cervarix and Gardasil. Gardasil is a vaccine that's produced by Merck. It actually has four subtypes. As I mentioned, there's over 100 different subtypes of HPV that cause disease in humans. The four subtypes in Gardasil are for viruses 6 and 11. They have numbers. And 16 and 18. HPV 6 and 11 cause the majority of genital warts. About 90% of genital warts in the world are due to these two subtypes. 16 and 18 are the predominant cause of cervical cancer and account about 70% of all cervical cancers are due to 16 and 18. So the four subunit vaccine protects against warts and significantly reduces the risk for cervical cancer. Cervarix is a vaccine that's been made by GlaxoSmithKline, and it's primarily a cancer prevention vaccine that only contains subtypes 16 and 18.
What's the efficacy rate then?
Very high. Because the body doesn't seem to pick up a response against HPV, it turns out that if you can get the body to produce antibodies against HPV, you can essentially abort and clear infection very easily. And there's a window of time, about 2 days, so somewhere around 14 to 48 hours or so, that an immune response as the virus is infecting basal epithelial cells will actually help clear the virus. And so if you've got antibodies on board beforehand, it turns out that you can actually have an efficacy rate in the case of these vaccines that are in the 95% plus range. So having a three-dose vaccine that produces large amounts of antibodies, those antibodies will actually clear infection. They don't prevent infection from happening, but they prevent what we call long-term infection. So with HPV, the issue is actually having an infection that doesn't clear, and then getting disease manifestation, either warts or cancer. So if we vaccinate individuals, they'll produce antibodies. In fact, the antibody response rate for folks getting vaccinated with all three doses is in the 95-98% range. They will clear infection when they get exposed and infected with those subtypes. It doesn't appear that the vaccine, however, works against disease. So if you have warts or you have a precancerous lesion, the vaccines actually don't offer any real benefit. So these are prevention vaccines preventing long-term infection and disease manifestation. And they work very well in both men and women. So there is now FDA approval in the United States for the four subunit vaccine, Gardasil, for both men and women, although there aren't any formal recommendations around vaccinating men.
On this topic, there's concern about safety, of course, as there always is with vaccines. There's a website called The Truth About Gardasil, and they say that at least 89 people have died after having adverse reactions to the vaccine. Is that correct?
Well, it's true that people have died after getting the vaccine, but it turns out that there are no adverse events in terms of death that we can attribute above and beyond what we see in placebo with the vaccine. So these vaccines are incredibly safe. There was some concern about the adjuvant in the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine and issues around pregnancy and vaccination. Now, nobody recommends that we should be vaccinating pregnant women. However, if you really look at the data, and I know because I was involved in another vaccine trial using the same adjuvant, all of the pregnancy data with any of the adjuvant was looked at. There was no difference statistically in terms of background adverse outcomes in pregnancy associated with the vaccine. So I'm very comfortable in saying that these vaccines are safe. They've been used now in a large number of trials with large numbers of individuals being followed. In the case of some of these vaccines, now we have data that goes out to 5-6 years, and the safety rate for this looks really good. The main adverse effect is actually local reaction. Most people have pain and tenderness at the vaccine site. But in terms of mortality or adverse outcomes in pregnancy, no.
Do the HPV vaccines carry kind of, I guess, the same amount of risk as other vaccines, like flu shots, for example?
No, I actually would say that the HPV vaccine is probably has less adverse events because we're looking at viral capsids. So there's no genetic material in these vaccines. They're not live vaccines. And they weren't rolled out sort of willy-nilly. I think part of the concern that people have had with influenza is that we look at different strains and we have to sort of re-up and put together a new vaccine every year, depending on what we think will be the dominant influenza strains. But the HPV vaccine, you know, these subtypes are very stable. And we're looking at proteins that are being injected into sites to produce an immune response. So in sort of the grand scale of other vaccines, I actually feel that the HPV vaccine is probably one of the safest ones that we have out there because of what's in it and what's not in it.
There's a bit of concern about what you mentioned, the marketing to men specifically. Have you heard about this, some of those concerns?
Yes, and I think it's a legitimate debate. And the debate that we get into is who's being vaccinated, at what benefit, and at what cost. So it's clear that cervical cancer is caused by HPV. It's a necessary first event. It's not sufficient. But we know that virtually every cervical cancer is associated with HPV. In resource-poor settings, we don't have adequate pap smears and ways of making sure we don't progress onto mortality associated with cervical precancerous lesions and cervical cancer. Those rates in men had been lower than what we saw in women, but we've seen more recently an increase in anal carcinoma in men associated with HPV. However, that's been almost exclusively among men who have sex with men, which we'd like to prevent disease. But you're looking at a very small segment of the population that might benefit from a cancer prevention around HPV. So the only other real benefit in terms of cancer prevention besides for men who have sex with men would be vaccinating young men in order to protect women from developing cancer. And you get into this issue if I say, well, and I have, that I think the vaccine is safe. Well, some people say, well, why would I give a vaccine to my son if it's not necessarily going to benefit him and might benefit his female partner down the road? Why should I take any risk in vaccinating my son? Now, we do have precedents for this for other vaccines and vaccination schedules. In fact, probably the greatest example of that is with measles. We vaccinate individuals, young individuals, against measles in order to prevent pregnant women from getting measles and having significant birth defects and mortality associated with measles infection during pregnancy. So we're vaccinating men in order to reduce the risk to women. In the case of HPV, we have tools such as pap smears and all that that will protect women. And there have been models looking at what's the cost benefit of vaccinating men versus vaccinating women. Most of these models really suggest that the dollar spent on an outcome linked to cervical cancer is better spent actually trying to vaccinate women than vaccinating men to protect women. Even though most women acquire their HPV infection from men, it's certainly not exclusive. We see HPV passed in same gender couples. That's true for both men and women. I think for MSM, my feeling is very strongly about that there's a real reason to vaccinate young MSM. So if you're a man who has sex with men, teenagers up to age 25, I actually would recommend that those individuals consider getting HPV vaccinated in order to reduce their risk of developing anal carcinoma down the road. But for heterosexual men, the issue here is that we don't know what population we're vaccinating for vaccinating 10 and 11-year-olds, to be blunt. You know, sexual orientation in a 10-year-old is not usually developed or understood. So you're really vaccinating a large segment of the population in order to benefit a small percentage, which might be legitimate from a cost-value standpoint, certainly. But in the case of heterosexual men, the benefit of the HPV vaccines, other than protecting women, is really about genital warts. So what happened was the 4-subtype vaccine, the Gardasil vaccine, was approved for vaccinating men solely on the benefit of warts. 6 and 11, as I've said, account for 90% of genital warts. And genital warts are incredibly common. Again, we're looking at somewhere around 7 to 10% of the adult population having genital warts. And there's significant morbidity associated with that and psychological discomfort, but not really mortality associated with genital warts. So the benefit here is cost savings and how people feel about themselves if they get the 4-subtype vaccine. The 2-subtype vaccine, Cervarix, really doesn't offer men much protection other than the potential benefit of anal carcinoma if they engage in anal sex as adults. And so there has been no formal recommendation to use that vaccine for the benefit of men. A lot of the cost-effective data would suggest that unless you're looking at really high vaccination rates, there's really not much benefit in terms of dollars spent vaccinating both men and women and trying to vaccinate young girls. And that's until you get to about a total vaccination rate in young women of around 70, 75%. And we're nowhere near that in North America.
Peter, this is brilliant information. Thanks very much for coming on to talk about it.
Sure.
You can find out more about Dr. Peter Leone and his work through the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk about the science of HIV and AIDS with researcher Abby Smith right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm on the line with graduate student and science blogger Abby Smith, who's studying the evolution of viruses, especially retroviruses. And related to this episode in particular, the molecular and biochemical evolution of HIV. Welcome, Abby.
Hello.
So let's start with some basics. What is HIV?
Very, very simply, HIV is a retrovirus. It carries its genome as RNA. So humans, dogs, plants, most organisms carry their genome as DNA. And then that DNA gets turned into RNA, which is like a message that ultimately gets turned into protein in, you know, dogs and humans and trees.
Right.
So retroviruses start out with RNA. But unlike other viruses that really kind of stay in that RNA state, they have an enzyme that turns their RNA into DNA. Then that DNA inserts itself into the host genome, in the case of HIV, our genomes. And then it gets treated exactly the same as any other human gene. So the host cell thinks that it's supposed to be there and keeps making all of these HIV RNAs, which get turned into HIV proteins, to make more HIV viruses.
So how does that impact the body then? If you could walk me through the process from transmission on.
Well, the actual transmission event, it's only actually mediated by a single genotype of virus. So HIV is famous for being extremely diverse. And individuals, when they are exposed to HIV, are exposed to an extremely diverse population of viruses. However, it's only one of those viruses that ultimately establishes infection, or very few. So what happens is an infected cell will travel to, say, a lymph node where there are lots of potential host cells there. So the one infected cell turns into 100 infected cells, which turns into 1,000 infected cells. And all along the way, you know, immune cells are the host cell for HIV. So it really throws your immune system out of whack. You start killing cells. You start not being able to activate branches of your immune system. And cells really, your immune system kind of gets in this hyperactivated state. And so there's lots of cells that aren't actually infected, but they ultimately die of kind of exhaustion. So all of us are protected from our previous infections. So the chickenpox you got when you were 7 and the flu you got last year, your immune system remembers that. But what happens with HIV is all of that memory goes away, or you can't stimulate that memory anymore. So pathogens that you should be protected from, you aren't protected from anymore. So ultimately, when you get to that point where you've basically lost several branches of your immune system, that's when we say that you've developed AIDS, and then you're extremely susceptible to infections and pathogens that you should normally be able to protect yourself against.
So is this a human-specific virus then?
Kind of. So HIV, HIV-1 in particular, came from a particular kind of simian immunodeficiency virus from chimpanzees. So you can't necessarily turn an HIV back into an SIV because at this point it's fairly well adapted for humans. But there are some primates that we can infect with HIV in the case of, you know, when we're trying to do vaccine models and infection models and that sort of thing. But it is pretty much a human pathogen at this point.
Now, you study the molecular and biochemical evolution of HIV. So tell us about that evolution.
You know, a lot of us have a pretty good understanding of basic evolution, as in, you know, the genome changes over time. And, you know, humans have a common ancestor with chimpanzees, who have a common ancestor with gorillas, who have a common ancestor, so on and so forth. Well, in the case of HIV, we aren't just dealing with a very small population of organisms. We are dealing with billions and billions and billions of variants, sometimes within, you know, an individual who is infected. Right. So then when you take a population of everyone who's infected with HIV, the kind of diversity that HIV can explore versus the kind of diversity that, say, giraffes can explore is drastically different. So the term we use for this is called a quasi-species. So let's say we're looking at an individual. If you took an average of all the HIVs in that particular individual, you could kind of get a consensus, just a generic sequence of, you know, what does the HIV look like in that person? However, if you looked at individual viruses from that person, they would all be subtly different than the consensus. So they're all genetically related, but still distinct entities. So what happens then is that, you know, normally the way your body fights off infections is that, you know, you start out with a very basic immune response that learns how to get better. Normally, let's say, you know, you just have a cut in your hand that's infected with some bacteria. Your body learns how best to fight those bacteria, so it doesn't turn into this big ordeal, you know, a cut in your hand. In the case of HIV, it changes so much, your body can't ultimately catch up and clear the infection the same way it would with that bacteria and the cut in your hand. And what we've actually found is, you know, this protein on the outside of HIV, it can change pretty drastically, and not just its genetics, like the protein, like the amino acids that compose a protein can change drastically, and it still functions just fine. So what happens is, you know, it's an evolutionary concept called the Red Queen hypothesis. It's saying, you know, you're running and running as fast as you can just to stay in the same place. And that's kind of where we're caught with HIV. Once someone is infected, that HIV can mutate just fast enough to prevent the human immune system from catching up and overtaking it. So in the case of an HIV vaccine, we want to give your immune system kind of a cheat sheet that could give it, you know, just a few steps ahead in this Red Queen race, so it can ultimately overtake HIV should that individual ever be exposed to it. Because once an individual is actually infected and HIV really starts revving up its replication, there's really not much we can do as far as clearing the virus.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Abby Smith, science blogger and graduate student studying the molecular and biochemical evolution of HIV, who's working towards the design of an HIV-1 vaccine. So, Abby, there is a plethora of conspiracy theories around HIV and AIDS and how it began. So do we know at this point how it actually began?
Yes. We actually know the colony of chimpanzees where we ultimately got HIV from. I would say, you know, back in the 80s, where our technology was and where our knowledge was, some of the ideas that are now conspiracy theories were absolutely valid in 1983, 1984. But with the research we've done today and with the technology we have today, they're all absolutely absurd. So like I said earlier, we got HIV-1 from chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. HIV-2 we got from a different primate called the sooty mangabey. But what's interesting about chimpanzees is that they don't swim apparently much in nature. So some scientists went to Cameroon where we thought HIV might have come from. And they started collecting poop from all the chimpanzee colonies that were kind of geographically isolated by rivers and lakes and that sort of thing. And so they collected all this chimpanzee poop, and then they sequenced all the viruses that they found in this poop, and they used evolution to determine exactly which colony we actually got HIV-1 from. And in particular, the HIV-1 group M. So there's all different kinds of HIVs. You know, someone who reads my blog regularly will notice that I always say HIV-1 and not just HIV, because there are so many different kinds and I want to try to be as specific as possible. But yeah, so we actually know exactly where HIV originally came from. It almost certainly came from just hunting, because over in Africa, they hunt primates exactly the same way as in the West, you know, might hunt deer or turkey. And so, I mean, anybody who has filleted a fish knows that, you know, you can cut yourself and people do cut themselves regularly. And so, you know, just butchering a chimpanzee who's infected with SIV, it can happen. And on the bright side, these transmission events, you know, you take a virus that is more adapted for, say, bats, and then a human gets infected with it. These transmission events are non-trivial things. I mean, people shouldn't think that, oh, my dog has a virus so I can get it, or my cat has a virus so I can get it. Actually, jumping from being adapted to one species to another is a pretty complex event. And it probably happened, you know, a gazillion times over the course of human history. But it just so happened that this particular kind of SIV coming at a very specific time in humans' history, you know, when we had colonialism with, you know, the Dutch and the British and the French and everybody in Africa, and with airplanes being invented, it was just kind of the perfect moment in human history for HIV-1. But, you know, these things have happened before, and especially, you know, with like herpes viruses, other viruses that we think are totally normal human pathogens now, but it just happened to happen again.
Yay, us.
Yeah.
So this is general scientific consensus at this point then.
Oh yeah. And actually, you know, I said earlier, some scientists were just collected chimpanzee poop or sequencing viruses. Other scientists went through these archives of tissue samples, these lymph nodes that have been preserved at room temperature in formaldehyde since the 1950s, 1960s. And they went looking for HIV sequences. And they actually found several sequences from samples dating back to 1959, 1961-ish. And the kind of diversity they found in those archive samples indicated that actually that crossover event from chimpanzees to humans came a lot earlier than we thought originally. And they've pushed back that time point to probably the late 1800s, early 1900s. So turn of the century, I mean, HIV has been with us for longer than we thought it was, but it wasn't until, you know, the 1980s where it finally came to our attention. We just didn't have the technology, or we didn't know to look for it.
We have a question from the chat room.
This question comes from Linda. What's the most ridiculous myth you've heard about how HIV can or can't be transmitted?
And I'd actually like to extend that and add on to her question. What are the most ridiculous myths you've ever heard about HIV proper?
So, you know, I'm working on an HIV vaccine, and some of the brightest minds, the brightest scientists, my generation in the past are working on this with not much luck, but we're trying really hard. And so, you know, I go into these talks and I say, we're really the only way to stop HIV is to stop new infections. And the only way to stop new infections is with a vaccine. But that's not really true. If everybody wore condoms, we would stop HIV.
Right.
And so the most ridiculous thing that I hear regularly that I love to debunk is that HIV can go through condoms, because people say, well, you know, these holes in latex are larger than a virus, so naturally the virus can go through. No, the virus can't go through. Viruses do not have tails. They don't have cilia. They can't swim. They can't move. They have to have a media to be transmitted anywhere. So in the case of condoms, they need sperm or vaginal fluids to be transmitted. If those fluids aren't being exchanged, then HIV can't be exchanged. HIV cannot go through condoms, unless, of course, they break, but yeah.
Right.
but that's one of my biggest pet peeves. If people would just wear condoms, I would be out of a job. I would be the happiest person ever. But people don't, so here we are.
How about myths around how HIV was created, let's say? I'm using air quotes for created.
Oh, all of them are so absurd because, you know, really, like I said, HIV crossed over into humans about the late 1800s. We did not have the technology to do anything in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It's very recently that we could even, you know, genetically manipulate HIV in the lab for research purposes. The idea that we could actively create this virus as a weapon is absurd. And the idea that anyone would use HIV as a weapon is also absurd. You know, when you have something like smallpox, which, you know, you can wipe out a fairly large population fairly quickly if you wanted to use that as a weapon. With HIV, well, not everybody who's exposed actually gets infected, and maybe you'll ultimately get AIDS 10 years later. I mean, that's the most ridiculous weapon.
This is a highly inefficient weapon.
A very inefficient and slow-moving weapon. And, you know, I've heard a lot of conspiracy theories on, you know, the U.S. government making it, or even on accident, the U.S. making it, releasing it upon the world. Well, my response to that was always, well, you know, how did we get Russia to go along with this? How did we get China to go along with this in the 80s? I mean, it's not as if the Russians in the 80s wouldn't have loved to say, look what the Americans did. And yet they didn't. And yet the Chinese haven't. This would have to be a vast worldwide conspiracy that goes deeper than politics for it to have actually been something created purposefully in the lab or even on accident. The thing is, you know, like I said, there's lots of different kinds of HIV-1. There's HIV-2. This has happened. It's just that we didn't know to look for it until we were right in the middle of an epidemic.
The other theory that I do hear quite a bit on some of the forums that I am forced to hang out with, in rather researching for this show, they say that there's no true link between AIDS and HIV.
Well, yeah, no, it's pretty easy. I mean, I actually have a tool I use in the lab. I've made an HIV that has a fluorescent reporter in it. And so I can actually take, you know, cells we've collected from someone who's donated blood for use in the lab. And then I infect them with my virus, and all of these cells turn green. And then a few days later, all of those cells are dead. So if someone really wants to watch a video of cells dying, I could probably rig that up for them. There's a lot of conspiracies as to, you know, the pharmaceutical industry wants to sell these drugs and blah, 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 blah. But the fact of the matter is, all of these HIV deniers that they themselves have been infected with HIV, who refuse to take medications, who refuse to take the appropriate precautions, ultimately die of AIDS themselves. So I think that's pretty much the evidence against that claim.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about HIV and AIDS with HIV researcher and science blogger Abby Smith. And before we go to break, we have some lovely news. A new radio station will be airing Skeptically Speaking. The wonderful people at CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC, are the latest allies in our gentle meander towards world domination. And that brings the rebroadcaster tally up to a grand total of 27 stations. It should go without saying, but perhaps does not. Thanks very much to everybody who supports the show. We very much appreciate it. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the data you leave behind, online and off. Analyst Keith Schoen returns to the show to discuss his work as an information archaeologist and how state-of-the-art software can build a picture of your personality through your online interactions. And science writer Jessica Wapner is back to explain why pharmaceutical companies are mining prescribing data. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I've been talking with HIV researcher Abby Smith about the physical and cultural response to HIV and AIDS. So how about treatment? What are we currently doing? And how has it changed?
Right now, if you're in the West, if you're in the US, Canada, England, right now HIV diagnosis is not the end of the world. We have lots of medications. We have access to those medications either through insurance or governmental programs. So HIV diagnosis in 2011 is not the same as an HIV diagnosis in 2001 or even, you know, 1991. The problem is, first of all, just speaking about the people in the West. So, you know how I spoke earlier about all of this diversity HIV has. Mm. Well, what we found out with AZT early on is that you might give someone one medication or two medications or three medications. The problem is, because of the diversity that HIV has, there are always going to be members of that population that are resistant to all of those drugs. And so normally escape from those antiretroviral drugs comes at a fitness cost. So those resistant variants are a very, very small population of the entire HIV population within that individual. And they really suck at replicating. But ultimately, over time, what happens is the few remaining HIVs will make mutations here and there. And it will ultimately figure out how to be extremely fit and to escape the drugs. So then what happens is, you know, an individual gets put on three drugs. They're doing great for 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. And then all of a sudden, their viral load skyrockets again. And so that's why individuals on antiretrovirals need to go to their physicians regularly to get their viral loads checked, to make sure they're remaining low. If they're not, then it's not the end of the world. You just have to switch to a different kind of medication. But ultimately, you might get to the point where, you know, you've tried all of the variants. And so then what happens is, you know, your physician might take you off all of the drugs in the hopes that the variants that are not resistant will repopulate and outcompete the variants that are resistant. And then you can try putting them on drugs again. But that's when things get really, really complicated. But one thing I do want to emphasize is that sometimes it's a misunderstanding in evolution that, you know, the viruses are evolving in response to the drug. And that's not the case. The variants that are resistant to the drugs are already present, but the drugs are selecting out everything that isn't resistant. So there's only a very small population left that ultimately repopulates the individual. So that's in the case of the rich countries.
Right.
In the case of the places where we need antiretrovirals the most, people simply do not have access. And frankly, in the West, it's starting to get difficult the way the economy is. Our governments have been cutting back the amount of money they're spending on antiretroviral medication for HIV-positive individuals. And, you know, in that case, I mean, this is a public good. So I'm very distressed about that. But in, you know, Africa, Southeast Asia, they might only have access to a drug. And then, you know, if their population becomes resistant, then they're screwed. In the case of, you know, HIV positive mothers, they normally, before they're about to give birth, they get a single dose of an antiretroviral to pull their viral loads down so they won't infect their child as they're giving birth. But then now the HIV populations are becoming resistant to that drug. So where we're stuck at with antiretrovirals is kind of the same place we're at with antibiotics. We're developing all of these resistant strains and we're running out of new ideas for antiretrovirals. So yeah, it's a race that we're ultimately going to lose unless there's some kind of technological revolution in drug design, or we can make an HIV vaccine that works, because if you stop the new infections, then you never have to worry about becoming resistant to antiretrovirals.
We're definitely going to get to vaccines in a moment, but we have some questions piling up. It's an email from Kyle.
Because HIV mutates so fast, does it ever change into something that's benign to its host?
And you know, that's what ultimately would have happened if HIV crossed over into humans, let's say 500 years ago. So what we find in primates that have this endogenous SIV is that everybody in the population is infected with SIV. So what happened was the variants that killed their host too quickly were selected against, because if you kill your host before they can transmit, that's a dead end. And then individuals that could withstand the infection at least long enough to reproduce were selected for. But that's a kind of Darwinian evolution that we can't allow in modern society, so we have to work against it.
And an email from Lincoln.
Is it possible that any of the strains of HIV could mutate into something that could be as contagious as the common cold?
I don't think so. Retroviruses are actually kind of wusses. Even working with them in the lab, you know, these are lab strains, hardy strains. If you kind of look at them sideways, they all fall apart and they're not infectious. A good thing about retroviruses is that it's not in the case of like polio or the case of like a parvo virus in dogs, which is super, super sturdy and can survive like out in nature on its own, just in like dirt. Retroviruses have to have a membrane around them that they seal from the host cell. And so that membrane can always be dried out or exposed to the sun too long, or, you know, just temperature, atmospheric pressure, that sort of thing. It can fall apart. So I really don't think we need to worry about that.
And from Mandy Dax on Twitter.
Since both HIV and the common cold are retroviruses, might research into HIV vaccines help us to defeat the cold?
Okay, the cold's not a retrovirus, but I get where you're going with that, and that it changes a lot. So there are lots of different kinds of cold. And so I think it's something like you can only get the cold like 200 times your entire life or something, because your immune system figures out how to combat them individually, and then you can't get them again. That might still be a wives' tale. But yes, actually, my approach to vaccine design might be applicable to other viruses like the common cold or, say, influenza. You know how you have to get a new flu shot every single year because influenza changes every single year. Or in the case of, you know, a couple years ago when swine flu popped up. If we could figure out a way to really kind of take into account diversity in our vaccine design, then we could definitely apply that to other viruses, even if they aren't retroviruses.
Just to move on to the vaccine issue before we take any more audience questions, why exactly is it so difficult to create a vaccine?
Yeah, so back in the 80s when they first, you know, discovered HIV, all the scientists were like, oh yeah, give us 6 months, we'll get a vaccine to this because we have vaccines. I mean, making vaccines at this point really isn't rocket science. The problem is every single approach we have ever taken with any other vaccine does not work with HIV. And the reason for that is the diversity that I spoke about.
Right.
Most viruses, most bacteria simply do not change at the rate HIV does. And we simply cannot take into account all of those variants in one vaccine at this point. So let's say there's one thing in a vaccine, one particular variant. You would be totally protected from that one variant and maybe some related variants. But if you are exposed to anything outside of that very narrow range, you can still be infected. And that's ultimately what we found with every single HIV vaccine trial, is that you make anti-HIV antibodies. you make immune cells that recognize HIV proteins. But if you aren't exposed to something that was specifically in the vaccine, it just does you absolutely no good whatsoever.
One can have an immunity to HIV, correct?
Kind of.
Okay.
You can have the ability to not really be infected, but it's not necessarily immunity. Hmm. So HIV, to actually infect your cells, it needs two things on the surface of the cell. One is a receptor and one is a co-receptor. If either one of those aren't present, then it simply cannot attach and mediate infection. So the receptor is CD4. And that is a main component of your immune system, the CD4 protein. So everybody has CD4. But the co-receptor, however, it can use two different ones, either called CCR5 or CXCR4. That doesn't matter. All that matters is that some people don't have one of those co-receptors. And that co-receptor is the one that HIV likes to use the most. So just due to random mutation in the human population, some people don't have this co-receptor. And so they simply, well, I would say they're extremely resistant to HIV infection. Hmm. But it's not, there is no one who has been infected with HIV and actively combated it to the point where they're ultimately cleared of infection.
How about a cure itself? Because there was the recent case of the Berlin patient, and maybe you could just tell us about that.
A lot of people with HIV/AIDS, some of them ultimately go on to develop leukemias or lymphomas. And what this individual's physician said was, you know, look, I've got this donor who is not only an immune match, so I can't just give you my liver. Like, we have to go through these genetic screenings to make sure that if I give you part of my liver, that your immune system doesn't totally reject it. Mm. So they did all that screening and they found someone who was a match for this guy to get a bone marrow transplant. Well, the bonus was this donor also lacked that co-receptor that I was speaking about earlier. So this physician was like, well, look, this guy needs a bone marrow transplant anyway. And people who intrinsically have this genetic alteration are protected from HIV. What if I gave this individual who infected with HIV bone marrow from this kind of individual? And this guy is functionally, I would say, cured of HIV in that, you know, chemotherapy and radiation killed all of the HIV positive cells and they were replaced with cells that could not be infected with HIV. That's fantastic. That's super. However, this isn't something that could be done on a worldwide scale. Not only just the difficulties with finding those immunological matches, so we wouldn't ultimately kill everyone we tried to do this with, but we would also have to find enough of these individuals with the appropriate variants to be donors. And that, of course, is overlooking the fact that we couldn't go into a rural Zambian community and give everyone bone marrow transplants. Because, you know, there is always a possibility that someone will die in this particular operation. The only reason why it went forward in the Berlin patient's case was that he was going to die without it. So this isn't something someone who was just HIV positive would get. This isn't something that someone who was HIV positive and successfully controlling the HIV replication with antiretrovirals would get, because there's always the risk of death flat out.
So what can we learn from that then? I assume we're still getting something from it.
Well, yes. You know, I think there's a lot of individuals who have submitted to like bone marrow registries. Mm-hmm. I mean, we always have those drives on campus all the time. You know, it might be interesting just to ask to be, you know, tested for this variant to see if Delta CCR5 is what you should ask for. Hmm. And just say, you know, look, if someone happens to be HIV positive, I would like to know if I'm, you know, Delta CCR5, and I might be a better match than someone else who also is an immunological match for that individual. Just if this could happen again and help someone else, that would be great. But like I said, on the worldwide scale, it's not overly helpful at this point. Though it might, you know, 10 years from now, who knows what kind of technology we'll have for bone marrow transplants. So.
And we have a question from the chat. This is from Kai.
I've heard that some kids are somehow born immune through HIV-positive parents. Is this at all true?
No. We've gotten to the point where, first of all, we're getting lots of kids born to HIV parents who are not infected with HIV due to the antiretrovirals we can give moms during birth and during breastfeeding. But we are to the point in the HIV epidemic where, you know, kids who were born in the 80s and 90s to HIV positive mothers are still alive. And I mean, they're 18 years old, 19, 20, and they've survived just fine, partly due to antiretrovirals, but some of them not necessarily. Because like I said, not all the kids are getting them. So, you know, there is something we can learn about HIV evolution and, you know, how it works from those kids. But they aren't actually immune. They're just doing extremely well.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about the treatments and potential cures for HIV and AIDS with HIV researcher and science blogger, Abby Smith. So let's talk about maybe some suggested preventative measures. You wrote something on your blog about bananas.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, like I said, the best minds of generations are working on this problem. And sometimes we need to kind of think outside the box. And, you know, there are some proteins found in nature that, especially in plants, I mean, plants don't have an immune system. So they have to have different ways of fighting off plant viruses than, you know, a mammal would. So, yeah, sure, look in plants, look in bananas, look everywhere for proteins that might be of value to, you know, turn into antiretrovirals or antivirals as a whole. The case in bananas, though, it's not technically bananas that are antiretrovirals. So you can't just eat bananas and protect yourself, even if you eat a lot of bananas. So what they did in that particular study is they knew which proteins they were kind of looking for. And so they purified and concentrated those proteins at a very high level that you wouldn't find naturally in bananas. So it's more in the case of something that we could turn into a pharmaceutical as opposed to, hey, just eat bananas. And that's kind of a similar case with green tea. Don't think green tea is going to protect you. It's not green tea. It's not bananas. It's a purified protein or some component of those foods that we might ultimately be able to turn into a drug.
Which is not the way the media presents it, really.
No, I know. And that's one thing that I really have to cover a lot on my blog, is that, you know, I will wake up one morning and have 20 emails from readers saying, oh my gosh, is this the cure? Is this it? Is it? I'm like, oh. So then I have to go and actually read the paper, which is universally not as astounding as the press would want you to believe. And so then I always feel like, you know, I'm kind of Debbie Downer and that, you know, everybody reads this Yahoo News alert that, oh my God, we cured AIDS. And I have to go, no, we didn't. We learned something neat, but we haven't cured it yet.
And on that note, here's a question from Jean.
Can you comment on the recent study that showed new cases of HIV among men fell by 76% after a circumcision program in South Africa?
I'm not sure they've like totally investigated why this occurs. But I think the hypothesis is that, you know, HIV likes to infect immune cells and immune cells like to hang out in skin. And I guess, especially in foreskins. So if you remove that, you've just removed a whole bunch of potential targets for HIV. So yes, in certain circumstances, I think that would help. But like I said, we could also just wear condoms. And then, you know, we also have the problem as far as, you know, if you're having a circumcision done in the U.S. versus having it done at, you know, an urban hospital in South Africa versus whether you're going to go out again to a rural community in Africa or Southeast Asia and do this exact same procedure. Because, you know, not everywhere has the exact same access to sterile instruments or even, you know, sterilizing capabilities. We run into this problem all the time with vaccination efforts where, you know, instruments get reused. So if you're, you know, just lining guys up and doing circumcisions with the same instruments, you might have more difficulties preventing HIV than you would in, you know, an urban setting, in a, you know, scientifically controlled setting. So it is something that we're still going to have to worry about or wear condoms.
And on that note, how hard is it to catch HIV? Because I have a friend who's a medical investigator, And he said he was shocked to learn how difficult it is to catch HIV. So is it difficult?
It totally is. It's very difficult. It's much, much, much less frequent, like risk percentage per encounter, than you would generally expect because HIV is such a huge problem, right? The thing is that, you know, even if it's one in every 1,000 sexual encounters, one in every 10,000 sexual encounters, you have to realize that people are having sex all over the world all the time. And an infrequent statistic all of a sudden happens all the time when you're looking at a worldwide scale. And it's not exactly comforting to the individual who got it from one encounter.
Exactly.
So I would say, you know, that number is going to keep going down as long as we can keep everyone on antiretrovirals, or if we made sure everyone had access to antiretrovirals. Because one thing that, you know, these drugs do is that they keep the viral loads down. There aren't very many viruses floating around. So if there aren't many viruses floating around, then there's not very many viruses in semen or vaginal fluids, which means you cut the risk even lower. So, you know, the points where you're most at risk of transmitting are in acute HIV infection, because, you know, then you've got a huge viral load. You've got tons of viruses everywhere. So you're more likely to transmit at that point.
At this point, who is most at risk?
I don't know if I could say that necessarily without looking it up, but definitely women. I mean, you know, this isn't the 80s where it's a gay disease. Right. I mean, in Africa, I mean, it's heterosexual women who are the ones most at risk. So, I mean, even if they're in what they think to be monogamous relationships, you know, places where women aren't as in control of sex and, you know, the reproductive rights that we might have here in the U.S. and Canada, and just culturally sexual rights that they might have in other places, they're definitely more at risk.
And one last audience question from Ben.
Because it's so difficult to separate people's behavior from their social and cultural structures, what do you think about the idea that we need to increase the involvement of social scientists in HIV/AIDS policymaking, especially in regards to HIV prevention efforts?
Definitely. I mean, like I said, it's like just to change some cultural attitudes when it comes to condom use, when it comes to, you know, preventative efforts, being able to get tested and to know your status without, you know, feeling like you need to sneak into Planned Parenthood or, you know, sneak into a clinic to get tested, to make it more acceptable to be like, you know, sure, everybody gets tested. It's just the way things are these days, as opposed to making it, you know, this really scary, I don't want anybody to know sort of thing. Yes, we could definitely use their help, even, you know, all over the world, in the U.S. changing that view, in Africa changing that view, in Southeast Asia changing that view. And I definitely think people are trying in the social sciences to do just that.
So is there anything else that we missed that you think it's very important for the audience to know about HIV or AIDS?
Oh, just wear condoms, people. You know, they aren't perfect, but they're the best answer we have right now. And I'm working very hard on an HIV vaccine. You know, I think we have a very novel, cool approach that I can't necessarily tell you all about at this point. But just wear condoms. That would be great.
That's actually really good advice for so many areas of life.
It would just make my life a lot easier and a lot less stressful if I, you know, I really feel urgency on this. And, you know, I wake up every morning, you know, needing to go to the lab, like I need to figure this out. But if everybody just started wearing condoms and this, the infection rates just started sliding down and suddenly it wasn't this huge imperative anymore, oh, that'd be great.
And that's our time. Thanks very much for being here, Abby.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You can find Abby Smith by clicking the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, keep clicking to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, on mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who, I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptics. Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.